Good morning, everyone. Thank you for joining us. Just a couple of housekeeping reminders. You should be coming into the call already muted. But if you're not, please double check to make sure that you're muted so we don't have any additional background noise. And then we'll go through the questions that were submitted to both Ro and I with the chairman. And then if anybody has any additional questions, please use the chat feature. And you can send it to, the question to the full group and we can ask, or we can you can send it just to me. So with that, I'll turn it over to you to start us off, Ro.
All right. Thank you, Sarah, and good morning, everybody, and welcome to our virtual brown bag lunch hosted by CompTIA and the Texas Association of Manufacturers. And welcome, Chairman Daniel. Thank you for being with us today. My name is Ro Jackson, and I am the Director of Government Affairs and Operations at the Texas Association of Manufacturers. TAM actively represents the interests and priorities of more than 600 member companies in Austin and in Washington, D.C. And as we all know, manufacturers in Texas account for more than 13% of the total output in the state. That was more than $230 billion in 2018. And manufacturers employ more than 881,000 Texans in jobs that pay an average compensation of over $85,000 annually. On average, each manufacturing job also provides 3.8 additional jobs in our communities. Texas remains the number one exporting state for manufactured goods in the United States, and now for more than a dozen years running. We're glad to be with our partner member CompTIA on this call. So with that, Sarah, I will turn it over to you.
Thanks, Ro. I really appreciate your partnership with us on this, and our members have a lot of intersecting policy interests, and so happy to partner up and really appreciate your partnership on this. So I'm Sarah Matz. I'm the Senior Director of State Government Affairs for CompTIA. We are the IT industry association, and we're primarily known for IT certification programs, but we also have a public advocacy arm, which is my role. And without further ado, I'd like to turn it over to a man who needs no introductions, Mr. Tony Bennett, who is our president and CEO of the Texas Association of Manufacturers. And I'll kick it over to you, Tony. Thank you.
Thank you, Sarah. Thanks to everybody this afternoon for joining us. We're very honored to have Chairman Brian Daniel join us today. Chairman Daniel was appointed to the Texas Workforce Commission by Governor Abbott in July of last year, and he serves as the agency's representative for the public, which means he promotes and supports the growth of Texas' world-class employers and talented workforce. In this capacity, his office advances innovative workforce and economic development strategies in collaboration with our state's education partners, local leaders, and industry to preserve Texas' competitive edge as the best place to work in the world. Prior to his appointment, Chairman Daniel served as the executive director of the Office of the Governor's Economic Development Division, and he previously served as Vice President for Business Development at Agricultural Workers Mutual Auto Insurance Company and as Texas State Director of Rural Development in President George W. Bush's administration. Chairman Daniel is a double red writer. He holds both a Bachelor of Science in Ag Communications and a Master of Science degree in Ag Education from Texas Tech University. Thank you, Chairman Daniel, for taking time out of your valuable schedule to be with us today. We really do appreciate the incredible job you and your staff are doing right now to serve our fellow Texans who are personally experiencing the worst economic disaster in nearly a century. I know the workload is tremendous. I doubt y'all are getting a lot of sleep. We are very grateful for your leadership at TWC right now, and particularly during the last few months. So thanks for joining us today, and welcome.
Well, Tony, thank you, and Sarah and Ro, thank you too for bringing this meeting together. It's definitely very interesting times. The last 10 weeks have really taught us a lot about how we can handle situations and what things that really need to be put in place moving forward. I have really looked at sort of the net result to the workforce from the COVID-19 situation. There are very few historical references that give us any insight on how to handle this. And so a lot of what we're doing is improvising solutions to problems that we didn't necessarily know that we could have. And we'll continue doing that. I don't have a crystal ball, but what little idea I have about how this works is there's a few more weeks of fairly intense activity, maybe three, maybe four. And then if I'm right about that, I think we can start turning our attention more directly toward how the recovery for our workforce, our economy, and certainly businesses in this state can move forward. I think it's going to be a large group of people looking at that. And I think all the ideas that we can bring to bear on that issue are going to be pretty important for us. There's lots of competing demands, as there always are, but the fact of the matter is we in Texas enjoyed for the better part of a decade a very robust economy. The underlying sort of the pillars of that economy, I think to some extent are still in place. How we understand how to build back on those is going to require a lot of thought and a lot of people working on some pretty divergent issues. But I think in this state, people tend to look for solutions and look for possibilities. And so I'm pretty confident, at least once we clear the current situation, I'm pretty confident we can move in some sort of organized manner to get things back to where we'd like to see them. I know that I have so many things that I can, and those that know me certainly will opine on. But there were some great questions that I saw that had been collected from folks. If it's all right with everybody on the call, I'd really probably find it a better use of everyone's time if I just answer questions that people have. And if there's time at the end, you know, I might hit up on some things that the questions didn't, but whoever's asking questions, I would ask you to ask the first one, and then I think that's the best way for the conversation to proceed.
Sounds good. Sarah, are you the lead questionnaire? You're muted.
Sorry about that. Thank you. All right, Chairman Daniel, thank you. Prior to the pandemic, we understand that the average number of calls into the Workforce Commission was around 1,300, and the record call in a day was previously 60,000. During the peak COVID-19 response efforts, we understand that over 3 million calls were made to the Texas Workforce Commission in just 24 hours. So we know there's a lot of stuff that TWC is already working on to respond to this influx of people, but can you go over briefly some of the things that y'all are working on to respond to this increase of the number of folks looking for information?
Sure. You know, we're just a couple hundred thousand people shy of having four times the number of initial unemployment benefit claims that we had in the entire year of 2019. So if you look at the activity that the agency saw in 2019 in terms of unemployment benefits, multiply that by four, and that's what you will have seen in the last probably 11 weeks, because when we complete this week, this will be the 11th week that we've been measuring. It is true we've had some days of 3 million calls. If you look at the fact that we have always maintained about four call centers for the state, they generally run on regular government hours of 8 to 5. That hasn't been the case for most of this COVID-19 period. We've had our call centers open 7 days a week, 12 hours a day. We've, in addition to those four call centers, have had an additional four outside call centers. We have doubled the number of phone circuits that we have available to us. A phone circuit then is capable of several different phone lines. We've tripled the number of staff that we have dedicated toward unemployment benefits. We have quadrupled the amount of computing capacity that we have, both in terms of servers that can handle concurrent users, but just also raw computing power. Into our ability to take the 2.6 or so million initial claims that we've taken in the last 75 days, and has allowed us to, at least on the computer side, on the IT side of it, to find a pretty smooth process. So 90% of our claims come from our online presence. It's an interesting conglomeration of tools that we have there, because the backbone of that is a bona fide mainframe computer that has green screen dummy terminals attached to it. And we have built a considerable amount of IT around that mainframe to power that. The mainframe really, like any mainframe, was designed to do, it just crunches whatever you tell it. And so there's a lot of forward-facing IT that captures a lot of data and prepares it for the mainframe to do its job. It's interesting because it has reliably done its job through this whole process. Our main issue has been on the phone lines. So if you had a problem with your benefit account, if you couldn't remember your password, if you entered something wrong, you were going to have to talk to somebody at TWC. Hence the tripling of the staff, hence doubling the call center capacity, doubling the number of phone lines. At 3 million calls a day, I'm doing the math in my head, and that's really dangerous, but at 3 million calls a day, that's like 4,000 phone calls every 60 seconds. And the average phone call does not last 60 seconds. It takes like 11 minutes, I think, is the average length of phone call while we're trying to solve whatever problem it is. And so every 60 seconds, 4,000 people were calling. We were taking about half those calls, and the other half were getting pushed into a queue. That is a situation where you're going to have a lot of very frustrated people, and understandably so. We've turned a couple of call center functions around to do outbound calls. We found a number of trends in the data that we're gathering on unemployment benefit recipients, and found some groups of people that we could talk to and block to really give us a chance to just solve problems ahead of time for them. And then there were interesting situations. We had a large group of people who, despite having an initial claim filed and in some cases completely ready to go, continued to call us as many as 1,000 times a day. One individual called us 1,000 times a day for 10 consecutive days. But when we would look in the computer, we would see that his claim was perfected and he was just simply waiting on payment, because it does take a few days for that to happen. So we called him to find out why he kept calling us. And he just, frankly, he had all the emails and he had all the letters. He just really needed to talk to somebody to make sure he'd done everything he needed to do. And so we've turned some call centers around and we're just calling folks. If we get someone who's just calling repeatedly, but we can't discern why, we just call them and find out why. The whys are interesting. That'll all go in my book when I write this. We're not going to get into it today, but it's fascinating how that human touch becomes important. We take 90% of our claims online, and that's great. Those computers are working wonderfully. But we have found that there's still a human touch involved with this, and we've tried to provide that where we can. Call volumes now are this week they've been, for the most part, averaging below 1 million calls a day, so that's good. The total number of unique callers goes down almost every day, which means we're getting to the bottom of whatever problems we have. We do see little flare-ups in terms of people continuing to file for initial claims. That's happening right now. We suspect it's the oil and gas market from what we can tell from the data coming in. So certain industries, they're cyclical anyway, and then you put it into the COVID-19 cycle, and so the cycles in these different industries are kind of off, and we're not able to predict with any certainty what's happening. And so we're sort of just dealing with those flare-ups when they flare up. And that's the best way for us to deal with that. We've got some teams put on there. There's volunteers from other agencies. TxDOT has a large presence over here for some folks that aren't necessarily working on anything urgent there. TEA, DPS have been loaning us folks, and so have House and Senate members in loaning us staff to help particularly make outbound calls, something that that all those folks are very good at. And they've been extremely helpful to us in terms of how we've structured our volunteer response. So we brought a lot of
Strong, this is Katie.
Using some cloud-based approaches, particularly those that we can meld with the mainframe. We're just getting a lot more information out there. including some artificial intelligence that we stood up in the form of a chatbot. The version 2.0 of that now is able to answer some basic questions, about 50, 75 questions that the bot can answer. The bot can also take down the information that you need to get us for us to make an outbound call for you. So now using some AI, we can get the fundamental information we need to make a phone call and just make an outbound call, thus trying to help people not have to wait in a queue or wait on hold. There's some other things, but I think those are the main things. We've deployed a lot of technology in a lot of creative ways, and I think have solved almost every problem we can, except for the volume problem. We even have enough folks to put on the phone, just not able in a 12-hour day to get to all the callers that we need to talk to. We're even looking at maybe expanding the length of time that we can have the call centers open, but fundamentally, the computers have to have some time to reconcile the data at the end of the day, so we got to have a little bit of downtime for things even to work in the background. We're continuing to look for solutions, and we'll continue to look for solutions, but we're making exponential strides in terms of the number of people that we can reach that need our assistance.
That's good. I know Ro has a question, but I just wanted to make a follow-up or a statement. I think, it's unprecedented times, but at least Texas is not the only state facing this. This is something that every single state is grappling with. So it's kind of an opportunity to see in real time where our strengths and weaknesses are. So kudos to the work that you guys have done thus far and in getting volunteers. I worked at TxDOT. I have several friends that are still there who are actually volunteering right now with TWC. So it's really great to see that and see other folks kind of come over and come together and help you guys. But at least you're not alone.
Absolutely.
Well, and here, Sarah, my former Senate colleagues are doing the exact same thing. So I understand. Let me apologize, Mr. Chairman, and anybody else that sees me grimace on this call. I've got a very spoiled dog that barks at weird times and makes me jump out of my chair. So but we'll continue on for the questions. That's why I stay on mute. Mr. Chairman, our next question is, besides record unemployment claims in the state, how else has the pandemic affected the work of the Workforce Commission?
You know, some of the other things we're working on, child care being one of the large divisions within the agency. Obviously, exigent needs based on the COVID-19 response and just society's response to the various tools that we put in place to deal with COVID-19 have changed the nature of how our child care programs have worked. So daycare centers were closed until Monday for the most part. And so people weren't sending students to daycare. Well, for our various daycare programs, including subsidized daycare for lower income wage earners, we had to put some measures in place to do two things. One, to ensure that child's slot in daycare is available to them when they're able to come back. And two, make sure that the daycare centers themselves could stay in business through this time period so that they would be available when they came back. I can't, it is hard for people to think about the idea of if daycare is not present, it's really hard to maintain great portions of our workforce. And so we have to really focus on issues like that. Then we had a short-term need to make sure that we could, and most of this money is federal. So Department of Labor and others had agreed, yeah, you should spend some of that money on providing useful and necessary subsidies to keep various essential workers in the field. So healthcare, grocery store workers, and folks like that. And we found that that has been a very useful tool. Truth be told, we've probably at this point offered those subsidies to most of the essential workers that were going to need them. And so we're I think tomorrow we'll start closing signups for those for essential workers. Now that was a 90 days, and we'll continue to help essential workers for the next 90 days. But with daycares opening up to their pre-COVID-19 clientele, we've had to make a couple of tweaks to that to ensure we have enough space. Daycare centers, as you're well aware, are opening, but with some limitations on the number of students that can go there. So that's one thing that we've had to look at. Our training programs, both our adult education and literacy program, and also our programs for workers, both dislocated workers, meaning those that are now have lost a job due to COVID-19 or in the unemployment benefit system. And then just our standard worker training program, we've made some enhancements there. We've moved about $32 million, both in some emergency money and then other agency money that we've diverted to training programs. What we are trying to see, and we're in the first 30 days of that, is for people who are on unemployment benefits to have access to online training, either synchronous or asynchronous, some kind of online training so that they can gain some either upskills or reskills during the period of time that they're on unemployment benefits waiting for either their prior job or what could be a new job to open back up. With the governor's announcement on Monday and seeing many businesses able to open at 50 or 25%, depending on where they are in the reopening process, we will start seeing that demand come back on. But we're seeing a lot of part-time situations as a way to come back, which leaves some time for training. And so you'll hear me talk a lot about the ability for people to hopefully upskill, in some cases reskill, to give us a chance to push forward in that regard. I say that because the first jobs that we saw come into the unemployment benefits system, the first job losses, were typically in the hospitality sector, retail or certainly restaurants and bars. And bar and restaurant with the limited reopening that they're pursuing, with the sort of phased reopening, we don't anticipate them being back at 100% for a while. This is a chance for us to see some training to help folks maybe move into a different line of work or advance in their current line of work. Before COVID-19, wherever you draw that line, before COVID-19, our problem was in the middle. We had many skilled positions were filled. We had an adequate workforce there. We had a lot of unskilled positions. We had an adequate workforce there. Skills that required some moderate amount of training. It was actually fairly challenging for the state to continue to fill those jobs. And while I understand the sort of hardships and limitations of COVID-19, I do think it makes an ideal time period to offer training where we can. So we've been working with community colleges and others to give us an opportunity to provide that kind of training. We continue to work through vocational rehabilitation for individuals with disabilities that are either in or wanting to enter the workforce and dealing through very similar COVID-19 issues. But when you factor in the disabilities, it just makes, I think, for a little more challenging area there. We continue to work with our workforce boards. The 28 workforce boards are, at this point, offering virtual services while we await guidance from DISHES and the governor's office on the best way to reopen those for the public to come in. I think we're very clear on what we need to do. And so you'll see us institute a phased reopening on those beginning probably the end of this month into the middle part of June so that we can get those back up and running. We will soon, probably at the next commission meeting, consider the ramifications of turning our work search requirements back on for those on unemployment benefits. As a number of employers are letting us know that they're wanting to offer work and for people to start back to work. So we will begin restoring the unemployment benefits system back to the standards by which we ran it before COVID-19 in terms of work search, continued claim. All of those will be put back into practice in the next, say, 3 to 4 weeks. Work in Texas continues to show vacant jobs, in fact, a little over 300,000 right now. We're continually trying to verify those with employers, but it looks to us as if employers are finding ways to continue their business. We want that. I don't ever lose sight of the fact that 100% of the jobs in the state are created by employers. And so when they have needs in terms of workforce, you know, our ability to fill those need to be intact. And so we're managing and hopefully balancing this idea that we can provide some training during this time period with getting some good implementation in place of how we can get folks back into the workforce and let businesses get fired back up.
All right, the next question is, where does the trust fund stand, and does the Workforce Commission anticipate needing to dip into Title seven advancements, and if so, when? And what do you anticipate the impact being to Texas businesses?
Yeah, it is Title 12 funds, and right now those are interest-free through the end of the year. Mm-hmm. So the borrowing on that was put in place with the bill that came out right before the CARES Act, and then the CARES Act finished that up. Borrowing interest-free, you're still borrowing, and so that money comes back into the system. We did not anticipate our trust fund balances being depleted until last week, and that held pretty well. So we are approved for Title 12 funds for the next 2 months. I know those approvals will come for the subsequent months. We do have to make an estimate on how much funds we anticipate using. The truth is at this point, all 50 states have approvals for Title 12 borrowing, and more states than not are borrowing from Title 12. In January of this year, we had started conversations. We were approaching our statutory maximum for trust fund balances. And so we were already having to look at management of that to ensure that we didn't go over our ceiling. So we were well above our floor. We couldn't have had much more money in there when we started. And truthfully, I was a little surprised in a good way with how many employers made their quarterly payment in April. We took in nearly $1 billion of assessments when we were offering a lot of leniency, and that's a testament to the employers in this state and our management of that fund. It was very helpful that folks were able to do that and did do that. Moving forward, obviously, I understand the impacts long-term with the borrowing. You know, what does that do to the rate going forward? And I wish I could give you a better answer on that, because I think it's important for businesses to have information to plan. But I know there's some discussions in Washington right now on looking at some programs to help states with Title 12 borrowing and how that gets paid back. We've had a number of strategies in the past that have really spread that out over a number of years to help employers not have to pay it back all at one time. And I will be looking at those solutions. I don't think we should, you know, plan on just sticking employers with a huge tax burden immediately on the heels of this. I'm going to pursue every available tool that we have to spread this out. And then additional relief from Washington, I don't think is out of the question at this point in terms of them helping states. Even some folks are talking about forgiveness of Title 12 borrowing, how that gets paid for. I guess the devil's always in the details, but these are the conversations that are going on. There's been no resolution to those conversations. We, at this point, through the end of the year, we know we won't run out of money for benefits. Also understand that we still have the capacity to issue bonds to shore up the trust fund, something we don't like to do, but have done in the past as an agency. And so we have additional tools even beyond those of what we've discussed. And with those tools comes, I think, a pretty conscious view of how that impacts employers and the best way to mitigate those particular impacts to the employers.
Thank you.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. And speaking of the CARES Act, how much federal CARES Act funding is the Workforce Commission going to be responsible for administering, and have those funds been made available yet?
Well, we've got about, it's probably about 470 or so million that have come our way. The bulk of that's been in additional child care funding, both for essential workers and for the effort to keep child care centers open. There's been about 87, 88 million that have been made available for the administration of the unemployment benefits system. That's how we're paying for all those computer and telephone upgrades to the system, plus the overtime that we're having to pay. And then we had about another $12 million for just general workforce services. That's helping people get back to work. There are some other pools of money, GEARS money and some other money like that that's dedicated toward education. So those are running through channels at like Higher Education Coordinating Board and TEA. But we're very much involved with conversations with both of those commissioners because there's a workforce training element that is inherently built in. And while we don't manage those dollars directly, in fact, the governor's office manages those dollars directly, we will definitely be involved in some of the ways that those dollars are expended as we look for ways to get people back to work. There's other funding sources available that aren't CARES Act related. They're typical emergency funding mechanisms that Department of Labor maintains. We've received some money from those and anticipate receiving some additional money from those. But at this point, all the CARES Act money we have received has been very clearly earmarked and was for specific things in specific areas.
And I have a quick follow-up question to that that just came in to our group chat. And the question is, how are you administering the pandemic unemployment assistance for marketplace contractors who don't qualify for traditional insurance, unemployment insurance?
So let me reframe the question and make sure I've got it right. Mm-hmm. Asking me about self-employed folks, you're asking me about independent contractors, probably some 1099 employees and some others. Is that right?
Yep.
So it's defined fairly concretely by the feds. It's $207 minimum benefit plus the $600 pandemic benefit that the feds are paying. So with no documentation other than you are an independent contractor or self-employed of some sort, you're going to start at $807 a week. You can prove up to our maximum rate, which is $520-something, if you can show us documents from last tax year, meaning your tax return showing what you made last tax year. It gives us some indication of what you would have made this tax year. That's more challenging probably for people who make their money daily or monthly versus those who sign contracts, and certainly for business owners. But the minimum amount you would come into the system just simply by self-certifying that you're self-employed or a contract employee, that's $207 plus the additional $600 that's in place until the end of July. Go online and ask for that. Right now, it won't tell you you're not eligible. Prior to the date we turned it on in April, it would tell you you were ineligible, but we saved all that. And then we just, en masse, the day it opened up, we just added all those folks to the system and got their benefits process started. So everyone who might have gotten a denial notice, if they put their information in the system, they're in the system now. And if you haven't signed up yet, I would encourage you to go ahead and do that because it's open and running. In fact, the additional 13-week benefit's open and running too. So, you know, if you were prior to this, if you were on unemployment and that ran out, you're going to want to come back to the system and get back on the computer and get your information put in there. A few self-employed determinations. Are we even needing to investigate? It's very easy. The documentation is very easy for you to show us that you're self-employed or some sort of independent contractor. And so that continues. It's once it's in the system, we've told the computer what the minimum amount is. And so it treats it like any other benefit. Continued claim rules are still in effect, so you got to call for payment on your scheduled payment. It works the same regardless of whether you're what I would characterize as a regular claim or a special claim. That doesn't matter. You have got to call and request your payments on the regular scheduled times. That's something that a lot of independent contractors and self-employees, they don't know. They've been self-employed or independent contractor their whole career. They've never been on unemployment before, and they don't have to do that. And so we spend a lot of time talking about that, but if you miss your day, it causes problems, and then we got to go back in and straighten some things out for you. So it's just unfamiliarity with the system. It's to be expected. We just don't like people to miss their benefit payment day and have to backdate something, which we will do because it's all we can keep track of all that. It's all in order. It's just if you miss your day, it will cause a delay in you getting your benefits, and we don't want that if we can avoid it. Mm-hmm.
Thank you. And another question is that we've heard in the news that states are all grappling, as we mentioned, with their unemployment systems. And we've heard news reports that place the blame on technology and not enough investment being made really across all the states. And So do you believe that that was, has been the case in Texas? And if so, or if not, do you suspect or do you see that there will be an increase in technology investments in the next legislative cycle?
Well, that's a great question. So, you know, it's been challenging here, and it's been more challenging for others in terms of getting an initial claim filed. For people who had access to a computer, get online, get in, that process went really well when all the right information was put in. Others entered something wrong or had something wrong with a prior account and had to talk to somebody. To go to the heart of the question, I'd put us in the upper half in terms of computing capability and how we've handled it. Other states, I won't say who, but it's usually for victims, had to go to paper applications. One state, which had plenty of issues unrelated to unemployment, had to turn their phone off. They just simply stopped answering their phone. Other states stopped taking applications for a while because their computing systems couldn't handle it. Here's the interesting thing about a mainframe system. It just works. And as long as you have all the right interfaces to it, it just works. And it doesn't really know not to. And you can't necessarily knock it off its groove if you're not messing with it. But it has limitations. For example, this one was built in the early 90s. I was still in college. It was a long time ago. And I'm sure technology has advanced since then. I'm quite positive of it. But it's built off of an accounting system. So at some point every 24 hours, it has to stop and count everything or it gets unhappy. And so you sort of just have to let it have its temper tantrum every night and count everything. Once it's happy with the count, it'll resume computing. But we use a lot of other technologies and a lot of sort of cloud solutions to spread out the computing power that we need. We'll batch stuff outside the mainframe, and then when it gets ready to, it just takes about an hour to get happy again. Once it's happy again, we just start feeding it data again. It just starts crying. You know, timing's everything. Last legislative session, the legislature authorized us to spend $40 million in federal money. We had completed the bid process and were about to award the contract when this hit. The worst time to take your system down is during when you need it. And so that stuff's been shelved. When we come back out of this, whatever that looks like, whenever that may be, when we come back out of this, we will immediately go back to this $40 million authorization that we have. We already have the cash for it. And we will be moving this off of a mainframe system onto a secure cloud. And what that will enable us to do is not have to rely on 30-year-old technology, but B, it will allow us to scale up and down with volume. So right now we deal with volume by batching, which is virtually punch cards. And this batching is imperfect because data integrity. When we're able to scale up and down with a cloud-based system, the computing side of this will be much more manageable. I hope that Texas never gets to do this again. I certainly hope it doesn't happen again during my tenure at the Workforce Commission, but we have to learn from the past and put those solutions in for the future. And so we've learned a lot of questions about this. The other thing that we have to really consider is the telephonic part of it and the need to call in and fix things. The computer is going to have to be more, it's going to have to interface more with the user, and it's going to have to collect a lot more information to obviate the need for telephones. I mean, you're going to have questions, you're going to have to talk to somebody. And to be fair, some people just want to talk to somebody. That's okay. But it can't be built into the system the way this is. So I would say we fared better than most other states. We fared better than most other large states. But it has not been a smooth process. And interestingly, since we were right on the verge of letting that contract, it will enable us to do a better job of contracting for the types of changes that we need to make for the system.
I think we'll go ahead and move on to the next question. Sarah, Mr. Chairman, Will the Workforce Commission be issuing guidance or a checklist for career and technical schools similar to the Coordinating Board's guidance for CTE programs under their jurisdiction?
Yes.
I love it. It's a good answer.
Do you have a timeline?
Well, we're working on it right now. I've been working with Harrison Keller on, frankly, just wholesale plagiarizing some of the CTE stuff. But one of our challenges is, particularly for the private side, is whether or not they're schools or whether or not they're businesses, and how some of the reopening various guidelines apply to them. So there are a couple of legal issues that we're having to hurdle through. It's on rapid pace. We got to get it done.
All right. And we have a lot of members that are also closely watching and participating in the 2020 reboot of Governor Abbott's Tri-Agency Initiative. And we've heard that the Workforce Commission is planning to start soon, possibly this summer. Do you have an update on that initiative and a timeline of when we'll get started?
You know, we had laid out what was going to be the most elegant of tri-agency programming for the summer, and we worked hard on that, and we were very proud of that. We're not going to do any of that now, obviously, and so I regret the missing the opportunity to get out, see some things. I enjoy looking at the different programs that are out there and visiting with the people that are running them. That's just not going to happen. Prudence kind of takes over there. There'll be some online stuff. There'll be some surveys. It won't be the same. But the data that we collect will. And the other thing that people need to probably understand is Commissioner Keller, Commissioner Morath, and I, we started our own tri-agency effort about the time that Commissioner Keller was appointed. And so it dovetailed nicely into what the governor asked us to do later in the weeks that we're following that. So stay tuned is the best I can do there. I know that we have been in constant contact with both other agencies and certainly the governor's office in trying to get a way for people to surface their ideas. But frankly, just between you and me, since it's just the two of us talking here, you don't need to wait on all that. If there's something you're interested in, concerned about, or want to see, just let me know. I'll get it in the process, but there will be a formal both survey process and probably a series of virtual meetings for us to really understand what people are interested in and are wanting more information about.
And in a time of prudence, I think that's actually very wise. Understandably, there are students and parents who are assessing risk and rewards of training traditional degrees or certifications or credentials. Can you tell us a little bit about how TWC is working with TEA and the Coordinating Board to better align courses, curriculum, and outcomes so that employers have what they need from the workforce pipeline?
Yeah, less with TEA and more with Coordinating Board, not because of any issues, just because more of our particular needs overlap with the Coordinating Board, particularly with community colleges. And so I've been spending more time with Coordinating Board than I have with TA necessarily. There are some issues that overlap with TA, and we pursue those. But right now, I think our main topic of understanding is twofold. One, we're trying to find a population of folks that with less than 6 months of training could receive some certificate, and helping them get that certificate via some kind, we're just gonna say distance learning. That's too generic for what we're talking about, but it's the best way for us to discuss it here today. So we're trying to find strategies for community colleges to offer the kinds of certificates that we know are necessary, and find ways to find them groups of people that they can move through quickly. Now, community colleges, in my opinion, are being very nimble here. Some of them are even willing to abandon their semester paradigm to get this done. That's conversational at this point, but we're gonna have to make that action item here pretty quick. And we think there might even be some revenue sources available to make that happen. So that's one thing that's happening. An area we're really focused on is our apprenticeship training. And this one gets more tricky because you do have to have face-to-face contact for this to happen. And some of these apprenticeships begin in high school. Most of them are post-secondary at completion. We've got to look, but you've got to go on the job site and you got to do some work. I'm talking about things like electricians, plumbers, HVAC. The need for those hasn't gone away at all. And so we have to continue to find creative ways to help the different apprenticeship programs complete those programs so that we can continue to license, those are great middle skills jobs, so that we can continue to license those kinds of jobs, because they really are the backbone of a lot of the things that we're doing. Those kind of infrastructure type jobs are frankly needed. Now, in terms of our involvement with other CTE programs and then our adult education and literacy programs, again, our training providers, just technology's helping us solve a lot of problems. But I got two kids still in school. I got a college junior and a high school senior. And I've watched their online learning experience through the, you know, the back half of this spring semester. And, you know, every teacher's different and every teacher approaches it different. And my commentary on that would be some are better than others. And it's true of most things that we do. And so it's for us trying to find the right tools. You know, the number one problem I saw with my own kids was teachers who chose a technology that really wasn't suited to their teaching style. And so for us, it's helping the instructors and the institutions understand, yeah, that's a super cool tool that you got there. But you don't teach that way. And here's a tool that might enhance your teaching a little better. My college junior, I'm purposefully not saying what institution. She gave, I think, a solid C+ to the school's distance learning effort. My high school senior was a dual credit kid. So she had half high school classes and half ACC classes. And according to her, ACC was a solid B+ performance, and her high school less so. So it was too variable by instructor. It was not variable by institution. They were all using the same tool. Everybody got caught where they got caught with this in terms of whatever level of preparedness they were at. I'm 100% positive that no one anticipated moving their entire student body to some kind of learning, distance learning platform. So some schools hadn't even considered this. They did the best they could. I think the lessons that we've learned has enabled us to be able to pick out the tools and technologies that are really beneficial. And so that kind of continues. We're looking for service providers that can provide that. Community colleges, as is typical for them, are finding some pretty innovative ways to do this. Unfortunately, or fortunately, you know, the state has processes in place. And so some rounds, and that's where we are in the process right now.
Well, along those same lines, knowing that the state's budget is going to be impacted by the pandemic, what's your pitch for the 2021 session with access to higher education funding and skills development funds and JET funds? Go ahead. Sorry.
No, I say they're all linked together, and you know, obviously, budget writers in the state are going to have some challenges ahead of them. And it's true, so much of our funding is federal, but both JET and Skills Development Fund and all of the higher education funding, that's general revenue, and there's going to be a lot of competition for that. But I don't think that we can really afford to just completely cut our investments in training, particularly for middle schools. A lot of businesses never had to close. They had the ability for people to work from home, and those businesses business. So many of the jobs that we saw moving to the unemployment rolls were jobs where if the incumbents in those jobs had just a little more training, they might have been in a different job. And so we don't really want to stop those efforts now when we have the ability, as we rebuild the economy, to make sure that employers can get to the kinds of employees they need to do these jobs. I am not blind to the fact that, unfortunately, some businesses aren't going to reopen. Some businesses are going to reopen differently, and some are going to reopen with smaller workforces. I understand that. It breaks my heart a little bit, but I understand that. And I think we can provide some tools to help businesses get that workforce back working again. But these training tools are so critical to helping us, particularly post-secondary and in this upskilling environment that we need to be in. These are our critical tools to do that. They don't cost a lot of money. We'll do our part. They don't cost a lot of money, but to cut them out entirely would really cut off our access to helping employers continue to get that pipeline of workforce that they need to continue to do great things here in Texas.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The governor has previously asked for recommendations to improve access to privately funded internships and to increase employer-sponsored educational opportunities for current employees. What ideas is the Workforce Commission considering? I know we've heard tax credits for employers in the past, but are there other things that the Workforce Commission might be working on?
Yeah, we're probably not as far along on that as most people would want us to be. Unfortunately, we've been focused on some of the things, but it is important, and it's important to me personally, because I think when we look at apprenticeships, internships, and just opportunities for us to forge some public-private partnerships in terms of education, there's nothing wrong with the state participating with a private company where the company wants to put up some dollars to train a workforce for that company. That really does help the overall state's bottom line. So whether we use tax credits or we dedicate, you know, ever so scarcer GR dollars to that kind of effort, it is to the benefit of the entire state to be able to put those training programs in place. My world's sort of divided into February and now, right? February and now. And, you know, even in February, we were looking at some robust ways and companies being right on the forefront of wanting to do some public-private partnerships with regard to internships, both at the high school and at the college level. And, if we're able to follow the governor's protocols to get things reopened, and that continues to progress as it has, and we are able to get to that point, I think we'll be back to that conversation. But at least for now, just the need to get people back into employment is likely going to supersede what I would call some more advanced programs like your question would imply.
And we know the governor has asked for recommendations for reducing state regulatory and licensing barriers to the broader creation and adoption of apprenticeships and upskill reskill programs by industry. And the federal government just authorized the industry recognized apprenticeship programs. How do you see that those federal programs and others fitting into the Texas mix?
Yeah, I think pretty well. I looking at ways to streamline people's ability to get into work, particularly where state licensure is involved. Yeah, I think it's in all our best interest to revisit those from time to time. Most of the license requirements were put in place to solve some particular problem. You look at a barber's license. You know, there are things on there that persist. Government loves to solve problems, but when the problems get solved, we never seem to take that out of the protocol. There's things that barbers do today that actually aren't problems today. And I could say probably the same thing for plumbers and electricians and HVAC and all the other folks that I talk about. I think it's good for us to revisit those licensure requirements regularly, but then understand where technology have solved some things. And if in the meantime, if we can protect public health and safety with a revised or even streamlined license process, this is, of all times, this is the time that we should probably think about doing that. You know, I look at the time interval between becoming sort of an apprentice electrician, and then 4 years later, you can be a journeyman electrician. But if you could complete the coursework and get the practicum more quickly, this might be a time to understand how that's beneficial to everybody. And so certainly it's different by license. I have been for a long, long time supportive of an effort for the state to really understand what's needed for a license. How do we get the health and safety protection that we were looking for while still letting businesses do business? this is, to me, an extension of that effort, and never more important than it is right now, when we're going to hopefully soon be looking at ways to put people into work and perhaps even seeing people upskill while they're getting into new work.
Thank you.
Sarah, I'll give you the last word. Last question, as we look like we're getting into time here.
Okay, I totally just closed it out. So I guess our last question is an easy one, and it's both from us at CompTIA and TAM. But given the living in the new normal of the pandemic, what do you foresee is TWC's greatest challenge going into the future, or even right now that you're facing today? And what can our members do to help you?
Well, Bob, it's a great question. It's about a 2-hour answer, but I've got 4 minutes. So here's the 2-minute version of that. Biggest challenge is going to be finding the right moment to understand and to agree to that we're not so much in a situational response mode as we are in a recovery mode. So it's finding that right moment to be able to pivot from responding to a crisis and moving our resources and efforts to what that recovery looks like. And for me, recovery is getting back to Texas being open for business the way that it has been. For me, recovery is people being able to move into private sector jobs, government jobs, but certainly employer jobs and off of unemployment benefits. And you know, I am completely cognizant and certainly not blind to all the different challenges, obstacles, hurdles that exist from doing that. But I think for me, we've got to find what that point is and make almost a full pivot to putting our focus on recovery, because the response is the response. There were some great things about it. There were some things that I wish we had been able to do a lot better. And we won't make some of those mistakes again. But people, I think, in general, look at a response and say, oh, their phone was ringing 4,000 times a minute. What were they supposed to do? I think people rightly look at a recovery and say, okay, you got one chance to get this right. My favorite part of ESPN game day is the "you had one job" segment. And I decided I don't ever want to be on that segment. And I don't want to be on that segment while I'm at the Workforce Commission.
Chairman Daniel Towney, we're thankful that you have an economic development program. We stand ready to help with, you know, bringing the economy back. And, you know, we've had conversations about legislative policies that are up for grabs this coming session with 313 and some other tools that we're going to need to bring the Texas economy back. So we stand ready to work with you. We really do time today. This has been to hear your thoughts on all of this.
Well, thank you. I appreciate the time today and appreciate all the support you guys have been giving me. Tony, I know we'll continue to work on those issues. These economic development issues are even more important than they ever have been. I think we've got some great tools. We might even need some new tools. And I honestly think we're just in the beginning stages of that conversation. I think even the short term and certainly the long term future of where we want to be, there's just a lot of opportunities for us to work together, and I know we're going to take advantage of that.
Sorry. Thank you so much for your time today. We really appreciate it, and we're finishing right on time, right at 1 o'clock. Thank you for all the work that you're doing, Chairman Daniel, at the Texas Workforce Commission. We know that you've been working overtime, and we really appreciate all the efforts of you and your staff and other state employees as well. And that's a wrap for our call. And we have another one scheduled for next month. And so be on the lookout for more information. Thank you, everybody. Enjoy your day.